to the Yes Live Show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, host for the show and founder of Yes to Life, the UK's integrative cancer care charity, helping people learn about and use integrative medicine since 2005. The Yes to Life show also focuses directly on integrative medicine for cancer, which means that I talk to a vast range of specialists from around the world, as therapists, doctors, oncologists, activists, researchers, and more. Today, I'm speaking to a leading practitioner in the field of medical herbalism. Chanchal Cabrera has spent a lifetime working with herbs, and in particular, supporting people with cancer in this way. I'm speaking to Chanchal over the internet on Vancouver Island. Chanchal, welcome to the Yes Life Show.
Thank you, and good morning, Robin.
So I'm really delighted to have been introduced to your work. It's quite clear that you're a highly experienced and highly trained practitioner, and you're drawing on a whole range of traditions, disciplines and technologies to deliver kind of comprehensive support to people with cancer. So really, the depth and breadth of your approach, I don't think really existed within one practice just a very few years ago. During the lifetime of Yes to Life, so I'm talking about the last couple of decades, things seem to have moved on immeasurably in that way. I wonder if you'd agree, and if so, what do you think this is down to?
I think that's a very good point, that we definitely have made immense strides in our attitudes to cancer care, both as practitioners and as patients. And I actually think a lot of it is driven by the patients, because I could say for myself, when I started in herbal medicine 35 years ago, we were not given a toolkit for cancer care. We were not taught about really digging deep into the cancer practices, because there was a sort of almost like a helplessness amongst the complementary medicine practitioners, because that ground was owned by the medical doctors. And they owned it in such a way that the patients were also rather disempowered from that process. So you became a passive recipient of the healthcare that you were given without any power to question or challenge or ask. And the practitioners who were not medically qualified were part of that marginalization, let's say. And I think that as the patients have become more empowered in general in medical practice across all disciplines, not just in cancer care, I think that's brought the practitioners along with them. When patients start asking more questions, practitioners are required to have more answers. So my experience has been that a patient used to come into my practice, I'm talking about, 1990, let's say, or 1995, a patient would come into my practice with a diagnosis of cancer, and neither of us would deeply question the treatment on offer or the management of the case. We would sort of, let's say, tickle around the edges of what the mainstream medicine was doing. So the patient would receive their chemo, they would receive their radiotherapy, and I would do my best to mitigate some of the harm without really understanding that there might have been a better way of approaching the disease altogether. And little by little, over the last 20 years or so, patients generally have become more outspoken, more interested in managing their own cases a little bit more, not just in cancer, but general. I think patients are more demanding now than they used to. They are less passive recipients of healthcare in natural medicine.
Happily.
Yeah, I mean, it's great. It's good. We needed that. But that's been, I think that the deepening of the opportunities for natural healthcare providers in the cancer field has come partly from that patient demand, and also partly because science is changing. And honestly, our understanding of cancer is so much better than it used to be. And of course, I'm sure in 20 years we'll look back today and say, well, we didn't know much, did we? But when I look back at what I was taught about cancer and the mechanisms and pathways back in school, which was quite a while ago now, but it was pretty poor compared to what's available to us today. So it's an exciting time to be in the field of cancer care, actually, because the ground is moving fast. One thing is, we never can rest on our laurels with this. always more understanding of the process, and consequently the ability to understand the individual's journey through cancer. So it's not just you have breast cancer, take these drugs, call me in the morning. It's now which type do you have, which pathways are overactive, which genes are mutated, and that individualizing of the practice has really brought natural medicine into game, because that's what we do. We don't treat disease, people, and we individualize everything. So the ability to dig deep into the process of cancer in a patient has created an opportunity for natural medicine to be much more creative in the strategies we
It's interesting, isn't it, how this land of personalization is a kind of meeting place for the direction that conventional medicine is heading. But as you say, it's always been the world of complementary and alternative medicine, as it used to be called. It's always been very person-centered. But yeah, it's a good sign, I think.
Yeah, and I will say there, Robin, that I no longer use the term complementary and alternative medicine. I certainly don't think that alternative is a useful term, because it implies you have to make a choice, one or the other, and that is not how we practice.
Absolutely.
And complementary is actually not very complementary to us, non-medical qualified people, because it implies, again, there's doctors who sort of complement them on the side. So for a long time, I used to call my practice integrated medicine, which I think was quite good because it brought in all the different disciplines that might be relevant. But I live in Canada, and we have a very, very strong Indigenous community here of First Nations people. And I have a friend who's an ethnobotanist, and he was working with some Indigenous elders in northern Quebec, investigating their ethnobotanical practices, their natural medicines. And they objected to the term integrated medicine.
Really? All right.
In their worldview, integration meant loss of cultural identity, homogenization, theft of intellectual property. And so my friend, the ethnobotanist, said, well, we're working in the, you know, this is what we whiteies, white people call it. What would you like us to call it? And they thought about it for a while and came up with the term collaborative medicine.
Wow. Okay.
And that's the term I've used now for about 15 years. I've called my work collaborative medicine. To me, that's a very respectable term, because it puts the patient in the middle, and all of the therapeutic disciplines, preferably at a round table, to collaborate. I mean, that's in my wildest dreams. Fact is, it's often just by letters and emails and phone calls between practitioners. But collaborative medicine means, what is the best for this person, regardless of my, as a practitioner, my personal preferences? I'm going to collaborate with all the professionals and all of the caregivers. It might be the family. It might be the priest. It's whomever it is that the patient needs in their care team.
Interesting. All right. We're way back with integrative we still use here. but that's, I like the term. It's a very good one. Yeah. Okay. So, I wanted to look a bit more at the sort of blurring of the boundaries between individual disciplines. And I was going to start out with talking about herbalism. Probably for the first time in history, the repositories of information on herbal medicines from Western medicine, TCM, Ayurveda, probably a ton of other ones, they're all equally accessible, and they can be compared, cross-referenced, and indeed seen as one immense resource by practitioners. So I'm interested to know, from your point of view, how this is impacting on the use of herbs in cancer.
Oh, that's a big topic. I think I would step back a moment and say that not any one of us can be excellent in all of those disciplines, or at least not without a long lifetime of work, study, and practice. So I have personally been in the position of running natural medicine colleges, and I've struggled immensely with the students who want to bring in a little bit of everything into their studies. So I'm teaching what we might call Western herbal medicine, or in Canada, we might call that naturopathic medicine, because it is a licensed medical practice here. You can actually be part of the medical system if you have that particular training. And those students have wanted to bring in Ayurvedic practices and bring in Chinese medicine. And indeed, naturopaths in Canada are allowed to practice acupuncture under their license. And what I've experienced with that is that they become a sort of jack of all trade, master of none. So spreading themselves so thinly that they can't, they may be very, very good at the technical sort of biochemical understanding of what is in ginseng that does what it does, but understanding who should have that ginseng and when and why not, and that the more esoteric, the more individualized approaches, that takes years and years of deep dive, including the philosophy of the medicine. It isn't just the technical practice of the medicine, but it's also the philosophy of the medicine. And that is a lifetime of study. So my recommendation, my personal practice, and what I suggest to my students is get really good at something and then start decorating it with the other skill set. And when I say really good, Robin, you know, outside of medicine, just in general, in education, I've also taken, because I've run colleges, I've got a lot of background in education design and curriculum development and things like that. And in education theory today, it is suggested that it takes a minimum of 10 years of focused study or 10,000 hours of focused study to gain mastery over a subject. And then you can go out and start to practice and be good at what you're doing. So, you know, in my own personal practice, I did my original herbal medicine training in the UK. You can obviously hear from my accent, I'm originally British, Scotland. Actually. And so I did a 4-year full-time herbal medicine diploma at the School of Herbal Medicine, as it was then in Tunbridge Wells. It's unfortunately no longer operational. But I came out of that program with what I would call core competency. I was safe, if not always effective. I wasn't going to kill somebody with herbs or misdiagnose them, but I might not know how to get them well. After about 5 years of full-time clinical practice, I started in Glasgow. I subsequently moved to Vancouver. After about 5 years, I felt I was good at what I was doing. After 10 years, I felt skilled. And after 15 years, I realized I didn't know anything anymore. And I took myself back to school and did a Master of Science in Herbal Medicine at the University of Wales. And then, so that was 3 years. And then, so I'm 18 years into practice at that point. Then I felt I could claim mastery of my subject. And I think that that's what it takes to be really, really confident in your competence. It's not something you can just grab bag from all kinds of disciplines and throw it in the mix and think, well, because I've got lots of different herbs in there and they all made sense on paper, that they're actually going to make sense in clinic. So I am concerned about people wanting to grab all the bits of information that go flying by and put them all into a cohesive whole when they don't have a philosophical foundation for that.
Interesting. Well, that was a great answer. How do you feel about nutritional medicine and herbal medicine? Because they seem to be blurring a bit as well. I mean, I quite often come across nutritionists who seem to use quite a bit of herbal medicine and vice versa.
Yes, absolutely. I think there is a huge blurring there. And I actually would say that that's probably more appropriate because after all, many of our what we might call medicines, I have a very large dispensary here in my practice, and there's a good number of herbs on those shelves in tincture form that would also show up in my kitchen. So I have tincture of rosemary, tincture of celery seed, tincture of oregano, tincture of thyme. Where do you draw the line between food and medicine? Actually, of course, Hippocrates all the way back then, he said it, like, food be your medicine and medicine be your food. So there really isn't a clear dividing line. And indeed, in practice, if you are practicing as a herbalist and you don't attend to diet and nutrition, then you're shortchanging your patients. You may not be able to do it all yourself. You may be referring out. But so I think that there is a natural and appropriate blurring there. However, I do wish that nutritionists would get more training in herbal medicine before prescribing herbs that are not classically found in the kitchen. So if I see a nutritionist prescribing turmeric, I don't have a lot of qualms about that. But if I see them prescribing something like, mistletoe in a cancer patient, I'm going to raise my eyebrows a little bit at that because I question whether they have appropriate training for that.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltz know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries, and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltz, part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide, where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltz, life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Okay, interesting. Another way that things have really changed in quite a lot of disciplines, it seems to me, is through testing. I mean, functional medicine has had a huge effect out there in certainly in the world of nutrition, there's almost nobody doesn't use testing in some form now. Whereas it was hardly on the radar 20 years ago. So there's all that, and at the other one end of that, of course, is genetics, which have also crept into all sorts of disciplines. And who in the world of herbs would have been talking about genetics a few years ago? Not many. So this is an extraordinary development, but it does seem to be. Yeah, a wide range of these disciplines that are now looking to testing as a background for their work.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And certainly it is novel in medicine to be able to understand the functioning or dysfunctions of an individual's body in that way. And coming back to the question previously about nutrition and herbs, herbalists will often prescribe therapeutic diets, but if they are, let me rephrase that, they'll often prescribe therapeutic diets, but it may also be useful to run individualized testing to be able to customize supplement protocols. And so in my practice, I might often send a patient to a clinical nutritionist for that kind of approach. So I can do the general healthy eating, well-being sort of diet planning, but I might be sending out to a specialist to get a much more refined strategy for an individual. But I do think that there is a danger in the testing. I will say I do run a lot of tests in my practice. A lot of the genetic testing and so on is very familiar to me in my work. However, when you run tests on people, and it could be as simple as blood work, your absolutely standard sort of blood work that a doctor will order, there's a little bit of a risk of putting patients into little boxes and saying, let's take as simple as a white blood cell count. That's really something very, very basic. And I'm thinking about a particular patient I have right now. You run a white blood cell count and you have that bell curve where you expect to see the range of normal numbers. And most people fall somewhere in the middle of the range, a little bit either side of the middle. But there are outliers. There are people who are naturally low and naturally high. And so there's one patient in my mind right now. She's a breast cancer patient, and she's been in my practice for over 10 years, and she's completely cancer-free. And she has always and consistently tested with low white blood cell count. And when she first came into my practice, her doctors were very concerned that her white count was so low and not catastrophically low, but definitely under the normal range. And they kept wanting to give her medications to bring up white cell counts, and even at one point talked about whether she had some kind of, you know, autoimmune deficiency diseases. And fact is, this woman doesn't get coughs and colds, doesn't have immune dysfunction. She just runs low white count. It's never gone into range in 10 years, no matter what we've done. We've stopped worrying about it. She's normal for her. So the risk with the tests is that we forget about the individual. We look at numbers, or we don't look at people. And often you look at one number or one small set of numbers and miss the big picture. So I think the testing is very, very useful when you need more understanding, more depth, more detail. But it is definitely not the only thing that matters. And it is no exchange for the one-on-one interview and the customizing of your strategies. You can't build a protocol for a patient based on the numbers of the test.
Right. Okay. Well, that's, I'm sure that's very good, good advice. Okay. So, another way which, in my experience, things have really moved on immensely in recent years has been the science of the interactions between natural substances and conventional medicines, which didn't really exist before. And for whatever reason, it seems to have really got going in recent years. And one of the biggest surprises in a way is how much maybe a single natural substance can actually contribute to a conventional treatment. It's, it surprises me. I mean, it's great news, of course, it's marvellous, but you wouldn't have expected that a single natural substance could do so much in amongst all that heavy-duty orthodox treatment. Do you want to just say a little bit about your experience of that?
Yeah, it's a very exciting opportunity for collaboration, actually, isn't it?
Right.
There's a number of very simple examples. If a patient is taking Herceptin because they've tested positive for HER2-new in breast cancer, you want to give them a fair whack of green tea because it seems like some of the flavonoids in green tea can upregulate the binding of the drug into that receptor site and improve the efficacy of the drug. I mean, those are very, very useful strategies. What we're always looking for there is to maximize the drug effect and minimize the side effects. And where you can maximize a drug effect, getting it delivered into the cell in a better way, then you might be able to use less of the drug and therefore have less side effects. I'll give you a very clear example of that with the drug Taxol, which is, of course, now semi-synthetic from the yew bark. And it started out from the Pacific yew, which is indigenous to where I live on Vancouver Island on the west coast of Canada. But now that tree is very endangered, so they're using other types of yew, including Irish yew and Himalayan yew, as the starting material to make Taxol, which is a groundbreaking drug. Taxol is an absolutely fantastic chemotherapy drug for solid tumors for a short time. It has a very good effect, but a very quick resistance in the body. People build resistance fast. So Taxol is a compound found in that yew bark. It is one of 27 recognized diterpenes in the yew, and it has profound cell replication effects. And because cancer is quite smart in some ways, it doesn't like this, it doesn't want this, so it kicks it out. The Taxol itself upregulates the multi-drug resistance pumping, the P-glycoprotein pumping that pushes the drug out of the cell. And the cell is like, I don't want you, you're harmful to me, you're a poison, get out of here. And it upregulates that mechanism. But there are 26 other related diterpenes in the bark, and some of them inhibit multi-drug resistance pumping. So when I see a patient come in my practice who is taking Taxol, then first thing I'm going to think about is giving them extract tincture of yew so that they have some of those other diterpenes and they may be able to get away with less of the drug and more effect and more durability of effect, because it stays in the target cell where it belongs, doing its job with less collateral damage to other cells. So those are the sorts of strategies that I bring to my practice, where I'm trying to really work with the mainstream medicine, with whatever the patient is receiving, to maximize their benefit, minimize their harm. And of course, I have patients who are not choosing to take any chemotherapies. And that leaves the door a little bit wider for me, because I don't have to worry about adverse drug interactions. But I will say that there are definitely times when the conventional practices are the right thing to be doing. And especially today with the new drug strategies, with the monoclonal antibodies, the immunotherapies, it's getting very exciting now, because it's not global poison. It's very targeted. And we can definitely use herbs to maximize that targeting. And really, it's a very exciting time to be in collaborative medicine in cancer care right now.
Yeah, agreed. It's interesting, isn't it, what you're saying about Taxol there, because, of course, they've gone to great lengths to extract one particular ingredient from this yew bark.
And yes.
You're doing the opposite. You're actually including them, all the things they've taken out.
Yeah.
And it kind of symbolizes the two different approaches to medicine in some ways. Is one, it's all about single substance with a targeted effect is the idea, and sometimes it works, but often not so well. Whereas the natural approach is kind of capitalizing on the multifaceted nature of all natural products, so that they're never single substances, and they always have multiple effects which seem to generally be synergistic. They work together to good effect. So it's a very different philosophy, really, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, I think that single compounds with a single target has value, because you can control that process quite a lot. You can measure it. It's very quantifiable. And in conventional medicine, that's extremely important. But here's my very cynical hat on right now. It's also a very good way to make a lot of money, because you can patent that. You can't actually patent tree. Although there was an attempt to patent turmeric years ago, and it was the government of India that said, hang on a minute, that's ours, you can't take that away. So, you know, if you want to be cynical about it, you could say that a lot of the motivation for the development of new drugs has a monetary basis. But I do see that in the world of research and precision medicine, there is some value to those isolates And synthetic products and what have you. I'm sure you know, I'm sure all of our listeners know, that about 80% of drugs that are in the pharmacy today had their origin in plant material, at least as an inspiration way back. And about 20 or 25% of drugs today are still made starting out from plant material. So, you know, we haven't quite left the world of herbs behind, even in the most modern medicines.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltzer know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries, and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltzer, part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide, where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltzer. Life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London, where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Oh, Okay, so can we come around to talking a bit more about you? Because you describe yourself as a medical herbalist. You're operating, as you said, from Vancouver Island, specializing in cancer support. Not to mention managing a farm and a large botanical garden. And as you say, you've been involved in education as well. And yes, you're right. You don't sound too Canadian. Can you just tell us about how you got where you are? Because it's you're doing a lot of things there in an unusual situation. Just, you know,
I do a lot of things. I'm a busy girl, but it's all about herbs. It's all about plants. My fundamental purpose, what gets me up in the morning, is that I want to connect people to plants. I have been an environmental activist all my life, and I actually believe that most people, because we're such an urban culture in Canada, in the UK, and in the developed world, we're very disassociated from plants and nature. And if you don't see it, you won't care about it. If you don't notice it, you won't protect it. So I actually have a not very hidden agenda in my personal life to connect people to plants so that they care a bit more about the planet and stop trashing it. I got into herbal medicine, Robin, because I grew up, I was very fortunate to be brought up on an organic farm in Pembrokeshire in West Wales in the late 60s, early 70s. My parents were part of that back to the land movement. And both my sister and myself have become medical herbalists. My sister is actually in Edinburgh, and she, for about 35 years, has been running. She's just sold and retired now, but she ran Napier's, which is the oldest herbal medicine company in the UK. That was started in 1860. So we both ended up in herbal medicine because of our parents, who were interested in all of that, who had books, and my mom was making her own skincare products when we were children. And my dad ended up, for some health challenges that he had, consulting with a herbalist in Pembrokeshire, who he's now in California, this herbalist, his name is David Hoffman. David was actually the very first person in the United Kingdom to stand as a candidate for the Green Party.
Oh, really?
He didn't get elected in 1970, but he was the first candidate the Green Party ever put up for election. Anyways, he helped my dad immensely, and my dad had a long, healthy life thereafter. And it was very impactful to our family to watch my dad be extremely sick and come back from it. And David Hoffman, this herbalist, subsequently told me many years later that my father had taken him aside and said, look, I've got this teenage kid who is getting interested in plants, but I think maybe herbs, but maybe the wrong kind of herbs. Maybe, you know, maybe you could get her interested in medicinal plants. And so I had always loved flowers. I had always, as a little girl, I was picking flowers, pressing them and looking up the Latin names and putting them in my scrapbook. And so when I was about 14, I started sort of volunteering in the clinic of this herbalist in Wales. And he let me pour tinctures and mix teas and what have you. So it seemed fairly natural evolution for me. I ended up living in India for 2.5 years. I left school at 18, went to India, and I was working in a TB clinic in northern India with Tibetan refugees. And they were doing all Tibetan and Ayurvedic medicine and having very, very profound health improvements in these refugees. So after some time, I realized I did have a brain. I should go back and do some college. So I took myself back to the UK in my early 20s and enrolled in herbal medicine school. There was really only one school at that time in the UK of any repute and value. And so I went there in Tunbridge Wells, took my training, and then I practiced in Scotland for a little while. But, you know, Glasgow in the 1980s was a challenging community to bring natural medicine.
Yes, definitely.
There were two other herbalists in Scotland, one of them way up north and one who was not practicing. So it was pretty groundbreaking. It was very challenging. So eventually in the late 80s, I had the chance to come to Canada. I landed in Vancouver, and honestly, it was just such a breath of fresh air. Coming from the gritty east side of Glasgow to Vancouver was just a revelation for me. And natural medicine just seemed, people wanted it. I was the first qualified medical herbalist on the west coast of Canada. It was an open opportunity for me, so I jumped right in. And I practiced for a number of years. I got involved with education. There is a herbal medicine school in Vancouver that's the oldest school, herbal medicine school in North America. It's just had its 95th anniversary. So I was able to, and they were doing correspondence programs at that time. So I was able to bring a classroom program to them. In fact, join that school up with the school in England so that we have a lot of qualified medical herbalists here in Canada now who are kind of matched education to the UK. And that has just brought professionalism to this country that previously there were lots of people using herbs, but not in any organized. And then I got involved in education because it just wasn't enough. It seemed like I was a bit of a lone voice. I was a bit lonely, actually, as a practitioner. I had to train up a few more people, so I've got some employees.
And the farm and all of that?
Well, I lived in Vancouver for many years, and I ran herbal medicine shops. I had three shops, and each of them had clinics, and it was a very, very busy life. And then I had the great opportunity. I went off to graduate school, and the Master of Science in Herbal Medicine that I took at the University of Wales was actually largely by distance learning. I had to go to the UK 3 or 4 times a year, but I did a lot. I did all my research in the US, actually, at a cancer clinic. And then I had the opportunity to sell my business in Vancouver, which had always been my plan. And after 11 years, I got an offer I couldn't refuse. And that basically bought me a farm. I'd always intended that. I knew that's where I was going to land. So I'm on a 7-acre property in a small town on the east coast of Vancouver Island, which is the mildest climate in Canada. We have actually had almost 3.5, almost 4 months of rain right now, which is a bit worrying because it's meant to be a rainforest here. But it's a great growing climate. So we actually have year-round gardening here. And I was in graduate school in about, what was that, 2002, maybe 2003, and doing very boring statistical analysis of long-term breast cancer survivors in a herbal medicine clinic. Topic was interesting, but I'm no kind of math girl. I was not enjoying my studies. Or not enjoying the tedium of the math part and the statistics and all of that. And I came across the concept of horticulture therapy, of actually using gardening and the experience of being in a garden as a therapeutic tool. And it just blew my mind. I was like, that's what I should be doing. And I got this kind of voice in my head saying, you should be working with plants. And I'm like, yeah, I'm a herbalist. That's what I do. And then the voice is saying, no, you should be working with plants. I'm like, oh, yeah, I work with tinctures and pills and potions in a clinic, in a building. Why don't I go in the garden? So I took myself back to school again, and I did a diploma in horticulture therapy, which is an international standard. It's available in the United Kingdom. It's available in basically all, at least the English-speaking world. And I trained to use the garden as a therapeutic tool. I have subsequently also gone to Japan and taken training in Shinrin Yoku, which is forest bathing therapy.
Forest bathing, yes.
Yeah. And then I had the great good fortune. I can't believe I was so lucky. I managed to get myself to Kew Gardens, and I took two programs at Kew, 2 summer schools, 3 months each. Came to live in London to go to school at Kew and learn about botanic garden management and about education in a garden. So I am doubly qualified out of Kew now in both of those practices. So I now run on my little 7-acre plot, I run one of the 5 registered botanic gardens in the province and one of 16 in Canada. And it puts me up in some rather exalted company. I get all the mailings from Kew Gardens, good heavens. But yeah. What I have here is a teaching garden and a therapy garden. So we run all kinds of programs for all sorts of people, from children with learning disabilities to we work with a refuge for battered women. There are all kinds of different people that come through here. The Brain Injury Society comes because we have a labyrinth and you can walk in a labyrinth, a very big labyrinth, you can walk side by side, and it links the left and right brain hemispheres as you're walking, turning left, turning right, and that's useful for brain recovery. So we do all sorts of therapy in the garden. And to me, that is also herbal medicine. It's just not about ingesting stuff. It's about experience. Right.
Mm-hmm. How interesting. Well, I said at the outset you were highly experienced and highly trained. That was probably an understatement. So look, we haven't got long left, but I'm just wondering, just say somebody comes in, they've just been diagnosed, and their friend says, look, you really ought to go and talk to this herbalist lady before you get started on anything. And you've got 5 minutes to tell them exactly why they should consult somebody like you. What would you be telling them?
Oh, gosh, that's a very good question. I think where I would probably start is about discussing the empowerment, the self-empowerment practice, because it is obviously terrifying to get that diagnosis. Although, of course, as you know, between 1 in 2 or 1 in 3 of us will have a diagnosis of cancer in our lifetime. But nonetheless, it takes the, you know, takes your breath away, takes the wind out of your sails. And in that place of fear, people make poor choices. And with all due respect to the doctors who are doing their best in a rather broken system, the system is broken enough that patients are very disempowered by the experience. They're not given time to digest the diagnosis before they're told what's going to happen to them. And they're actively discouraged for the most part from questioning that. So usually if somebody's just been diagnosed and they come to me, before they do much else, I'm going to suggest that they just stop for a little while and catch their breath and do some homework on what their options are. Because almost all cancers have actually been going for years before they're diagnosed. There's very few that show up right away. Usually it's anywhere, you know, you get diagnosed with breast cancer, there's a good probability it's been ticking away there for about 4 or 5 years before it's big enough for you to notice. So another month of homework and research and consideration and gathering information, that is helpful. It is not dangerous. So when you get diagnosed on Monday and you're into treatment on Friday, I think that's wrong. I really, really think people need to stop and take a step back and say, what do I want this to look like? How can I manage my own well-being to the best advantage? And then put their care team together, put their collaborative team of health providers and support people in place so that they feel empowered to do things for themselves and not just be a passive recipient of whatever the doctor suggests. I strongly recommend second opinions because there is no single right answer and patients need to be involved in that process. Oh, and I would also say, stop eating all the sugar in your diet, dump the sugar, anything white in the cupboard should go. And, you know, there's some very ground rule kind of health things about stress management, quitting smoking, you know, the fairly obvious things. But more than anything, people need to take back their power. They need to be guiding their own process. And they need information to do that. You can't just do that out of the blue if you've never thought about that before. You need some support for that. Mm. So that's what I would suggest. Take time. Take the time to put a plan in place.
Okay, and just say they're building that team of people. Reasons they would choose a herbalist to be one of their team.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, herbal medicine is so, so congruent with everything else. So if they are seeing a nutritionist and they're seeing an oncologist, the herbalist is almost like the bridge between, because the herbalist is actually going to be able to navigate between the chemotherapy drugs and the optimal nutrition and help to find that path that links those things. I will say that many herbalists are not that comfortable yet in the world of cancer care. It's touched upon, of course, in our education, but it is a specialist arena. And so I would say for a patient that they should seek out a herbalist who has experience and training and expertise in cancer care, not necessarily every herbalist is going to be able to offer that.
No. Yeah, that's the case with most disciplines, really. Cancer is always a specialist subject, really.
Yeah, and so
even
in nutrition, I think not every high street nutritionist is going to have a deep skill set. They could all help you get a healthy diet going and some basic supplements, but to really dig into this, what we would call orthomolecular nutrition, which is this supplement in this form in this dose for this marker in your blood or this genetic quote, that's a specialist arena.
Yeah, and one of the things about being at the outset of the journey, as this person I've been describing is that actually you don't know what to expect, and therefore you don't even know what you're going to need. So what do you think you would offer them in terms of, again, advice about what the challenges are going to be and how you can help them with those?
Yeah, I think what I always do with my patients is encourage them to ask questions. And not to just take everything at face value. So regrettably, Canada, like the UK, has a national health plan, and everybody gets healthcare, but not everybody gets great care because actually there's not enough to go around. So regrettably, the squeaky wheel gets the oil. If you ask questions and put yourself out there to engage in your own process, then you will actually get better care. So I a lot of my work is about trying to empower my patients to feel that they have the right to ask questions, that they have the right to challenge what they're being told, or at least to ask for some references, some backup, some not just, well, this is what we do, and, you know, in a sort of top-down hierarchical model, which sadly is how our healthcare programs have devolved. So I, you know, a lot of what I do is I don't practice primary care. I mean, in Canada, I'm not licensed for that. So I consider myself, if anything, maybe a health coach I literally give my patients lists of questions to ask their doctors. Or I get on the phone myself and I talk to the doctor.
Well, that's very interesting because, of course, it's not everybody's picture of what a herbalist does. A health coach. And do you think part of the reason you see yourself in that way is because you have such a broad base you're working from in a way? You call yourself a medical herbalist, but actually you're quite widely trained, aren't you?
Yes. I think what happened for myself was that I didn't really engage in cancer care for the first 15 years of my practice. A patient would come in and I would do what I call tweaking around the edges, just trying to help them to tolerate the drugs a bit better. I never really understood enough about it to question it very much. And it wasn't until I went back to graduate school and did this, you know, very intensive training in what we would call holistic oncology, that I began to understand how little the medical system understands what they're doing. It is one size fits all. You get this approved drug cocktail for this cancer as if everybody with that cancer is the same. And there's, you know, and I'm talking 20 years ago now, I do think it's improved and changed over the last couple of decades. But back then when I went into grad school, it was really one size fits all, color by numbers kind of medical practice. And I just think that we've all evolved immensely. Patients, practitioners, and the practice of oncology has evolved. So what I call holistic oncology includes, yes, diet, yes, meditation and stress management, yes, herbs, yes, drugs, yes, surgery. You know, it's whatever's right for that patient in their personal circumstances. And I have been the one sometimes insisting that a patient should be taking chemo because it's the right thing for them and they're just afraid of it or they don't understand it or they have a sort of instinctive philosophical no to that kind of medicine. And I'm saying, look, you have this marker. And this drug will work for you. You'd be crazy not to do it. And equally, I've been the one sometimes saying, why are they giving you that you've actually tested this marker, that drug's not going to work for you. Or why don't you test these markers to know if it's going to work or taking it? So that's why I call myself a health coach or a health educator, because I'm often just telling the patients what they should look out for to get the best results. And of course, I give them herbs.
Of course. Okay, look, we're going to have to end it there, Chanchal. Really interesting. I'm sure everyone listening will want to join me in appreciating hearing from someone like you who's got so much experience and knowledge. Fascinating. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Robin. My pleasure indeed. I would like to just close by saying that for your audience, I don't know where everybody is located, but most countries do have an association of professional herbalists. And in the United Kingdom, you have two. You have the National Institute of Medical Herbalists, and you have the College of Practitioners of Phytotherapy. And both of those organizations have referral directories. And I would really encourage your listeners to seek out a qualified herbalist, not just the person behind the counter in the health food store on the high street. And those herbalists, if they're not feeling confident or competent themselves, will then make an appropriate referral. And actually, they often use me as a mentor. I do a lot of coaching of practitioners. So I just would encourage people to seek out a professional if they're going to use herbs in cancer care, because it is tricky work. And not every person who loves herbs is going to have that expertise.
Sound advice. All right. Thank you very much, Chanchal.
Yes, thank you. My pleasure. Bye-bye for now.
Bye-bye then. If you're considering who you need to support you through cancer, hopefully our talk today will make you want to add a medical herbalist to the list for consideration, as they're clearly a great resource. Many thanks for listening today. I do hope you'll want to join me again next week for another episode of the Yes Life Show, here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.